Welcome to Lindy Upgrade Studio. Our TOEFL reading podcast helps you build the background knowledge, academic vocabulary, and useful expressions behind real TOEFL reading passages. So whether you're out for a run, at the gym, on your commute, or doing chores around the house, pop in your earbuds and let English sink in naturally.
You know, I want you to imagine, just for a moment, two massive sports stadiums.
Okay, I'm picturing it.
Right, so in the first stadium, the environment is just, it's chaotic and toxic. Fans are screaming at each other. They're throwing bottles onto the field, fighting in the parking lot after the game. The sport has basically become an excuse for hostility.
Yeah, we've all seen that on the news.
Exactly. Now visualize a second stadium. In this one, two rival nations that perhaps have a history of really deep political conflict are marching side by side behind the same flag during an opening ceremony. And millions of people around the world are just watching in awe.
Wow, that's a brilliant contrast to start us off. And it perfectly captures this incredible dual nature of what we're unpacking today.
It really does.
We're looking at the exact mechanisms that cause sports to either tear a society apart or, you know, heal it.
Which is an incredibly relevant topic. I mean, not just for passing a language exam, but for understanding the human condition in general.
Absolutely. So to give you, the listener, some orientation, today we're focusing our deep dive on article number 03. The title of today's passage is The Impact of Sports on Social Integration.
It's a great piece.
It is. But before we get into the heavy lifting, the vocabulary and the structure of this text, I think it's crucial to create a thematic link to our previous discussion. Because if you joined us for Article 02, you'll remember we spent a lot of time dissecting the paradox of choice.
Oh, right. That was a fascinating psychological exploration. We looked at how, you know, standing in a supermarket aisle paralyzed by 50 different flavors of jam can actually trigger intense anxiety.
Yeah, that jam aisle is terrifying.
Yeah, it really is. And the core takeaway from that previous passage was that having too many options, like too much individual freedom to choose, can ironically lead to immense stress and a really deep sense of isolation.
Yes, and that isolation is key. The paradox of choice is ultimately about being trapped inside your own head, right?
Exactly.
It's about what separates us as individuals. When you're agonizing over a decision, you are completely disconnected from the world around you.
Which serves as like the perfect mirror image for today's passage. We are completely flipping the coin.
Right.
If the previous text was about the psychology of isolation, well, today's text is about the sociology of connection. What pulls us out of our individual heads, you know, what brings us together.
And as we explore those questions, our mission remains exactly the same. We're going to break down this real TOEFL academic reading passage sentence by sentence.
That's right.
So for those of you sitting at a B1 or B2 level in your English learning journey, we are here to guide you across the bridge into C1 territory.
We'll pull out the high-level academic vocabulary that frequently appears in university-level texts. We'll deconstruct the complex phrasing so you can understand the mechanics of the sentences.
And most importantly, we'll map out the logical architecture of the author's argument. Because succeeding on the TOEFL, or I mean any academic environment, it requires more than just memorizing a dictionary.
Yeah, much more.
You have to recognize how a writer builds their case, how they present evidence, and how they handle opposing viewpoints.
So let's begin by looking at the broad foundation the author lays down. The passage starts by making a very sweeping claim about sports acting as a mechanism to connect incredibly diverse groups of people.
Let's hear it.
I'd love for you to read the opening sentences so we can hear the exact phrasing, actually.
Oh, absolutely. So listen closely to the nouns and verbs the author chooses here to establish their thesis. The text begins, "Sports can promote social integration by bridging gaps between people of various backgrounds. Participation in sports can lead to increased social cohesion and improve relationships among diverse groups."
Those two sentences represent the beating heart of the entire passage.
They really do.
Every paragraph that follows will be dedicated to proving the claims made right there. And we immediately encounter two absolute heavyweight C1 vocabulary words that we just have to unpack.
Oh, yeah. Integration and cohesion.
Exactly. Let's start with integration. The text specifically refers to social integration.
You know, when you look at a word like integration, it can feel very abstract. It's one of those words you hear on the news constantly, but like if someone asks you to define it on the spot, it might be pretty difficult.
It's a tricky one to pin down.
Right. So to really grasp it, we need to dig into its history.
And the best way to demystify a word like this is to look at its Latin root. Integration actually comes from the Latin word integer.
Integer, okay.
Yeah, and if you have ever taken a mathematics course in English, That word should sound very familiar. An integer is a whole number.
Oh, right. Like the number 1 or 7 or 100. It's not a fraction like 1/2, and it's not a decimal like 3.5. It's a solid, complete unit.
Building on that mathematical concept, the root meaning of integer is whole or untouched. So when we turn that root into the noun integration, we're describing a very specific process.
Which is?
It's the process of taking separate, broken, or divided parts and bringing them together to create a single unified whole.
I find it incredibly helpful to visualize this. Like, think about a jigsaw puzzle.
Oh, that's a good analogy.
Right. When you first dump a puzzle out of the box, you have 1,000 tiny disconnected pieces scattered all over the table. Each piece is an individual unit, completely isolated from the rest.
But as you spend time analyzing the shapes, finding the matching colors, and locking those pieces together edge to edge, you are actively performing integration.
Yes.
You're taking the scattered fragments and building one complete, coherent picture.
And when we apply that to the phrase in the text, you know, social integration, the puzzle pieces represent human beings. In any society, you have people from vastly different religious backgrounds, different economic classes, different age groups, and different political beliefs.
All those separate pieces.
Exactly. Social integration is the ongoing effort to ensure these diverse groups don't remain isolated in their own separate corners of the puzzle board. It's making sure they function together as one healthy, interconnected society.
And as a learner trying to elevate your English, you also need to focus on collocations. You know, the words that naturally pair together. Social integration is a vital collocation, but you also frequently read about economic integration.
That's a great example. Economic integration happens when neighboring countries decide to remove taxes and tariffs. They combine their separate markets so they can trade as one giant whole economy.
Like the European Union.
The European Union is a classic example of economic integration, yeah.
Now, if we look back at the text, the author follows up social integration with another crucial term in the very next sentence. They claim that participating in sports leads to increased social cohesion.
Cohesion, that is a fantastic word. It sounds incredibly academic, but its origins are actually intensely physical.
They really are. Let's break it down into its two parts. First, we have the prefix co, C-A-O. This is a highly productive prefix in English.
Super common.
Right. And whenever you see it, your brain should immediately register the concept of together.
Think of everyday words. A coworker is someone you work together with.
Exactly.
To cooperate is to operate or act together. A co-pilot flies the plane together with the captain.
Perfect examples. Now, the second part of the word comes from a Latin root meaning to stick or to cling. You can actually see this same root in the English word adhesive.
Oh, like glue.
Yes. When you go to the hardware store to buy glue, epoxy, or heavy-duty tape, you are buying an adhesive. It's a substance designed to make two separate surfaces stick together permanently.
So if we combine those two elements, co meaning together, and the root meaning to stick, the literal definition of cohesion is the act or state of sticking together tightly.
Therefore, when the author writes about social cohesion, they're essentially asking a very physical question about a community. Like, how sticky is this society?
How tightly bonded are the people living in this neighborhood or this country?
Exactly.
To make this even more concrete, let's build an analogy. I like to think of human society as a large brick wall. The individual people, you, me, our neighbors, we are the bricks. Now, you can take 1,000 high-quality heavy bricks and stack them on top of each other.
You might even stack them very neatly.
Right, very neat. But if you just stack them dry, with nothing in between them, that wall is incredibly fragile.
One push and it's over.
Exactly. The first time a strong storm rolls through or an earthquake hits, that wall is going to collapse. The bricks will scatter everywhere.
Because while they're occupying the same physical space, there's nothing binding them. They completely lack a unifying force.
Right. What that wall desperately needs is mortar, that thick, wet cement mixture that a bricklayer spreads between every single block.
The glue.
The glue, yes. The mortar fills in all the empty gaps. It grabs onto the rough surface of the bottom brick and bonds chemically to the rough surface of the top brick.
Then once that mortar dries and hardens, you no longer have a pile of individual bricks. You have a fortress.
You have a wall that can withstand a hurricane. The mortar provides the cohesion.
That analogy perfectly illustrates the author's central thesis. The author is suggesting that in a community made up of very different bricks, people of various backgrounds, sports, act as the societal mortar.
They're the adhesive glue providing the social cohesion that keeps the community from collapsing during stressful times.
And the author uses a very specific, highly visual academic expression to describe how this works in practice. In the first sentence, the text states that sports promote integration by bridging gaps between people.
Bridging gaps. It's a metaphor, but it's used so ubiquitously in formal English writing that it functions as standard academic vocabulary.
It really does. Let's visualize the landscape of this metaphor. Imagine two towering cliffs facing each other. On the left cliff, you have one group of people. Perhaps they come from a very affluent, wealthy neighborhood.
Okay, I see it.
On the right cliff, you have a completely different group of people. Perhaps they come from a working-class neighborhood and speak a different language at home.
And between these two cliffs is a deep, fast-moving, dangerous river.
Right.
That river represents the gap the author is talking about. It's the geographical, cultural, or economic barrier that prevents these two groups from ever naturally interacting. In their normal daily routines, they will literally never cross paths.
So if you want those two groups to communicate, you can't just yell across the river. You have to engineer a solution.
You must build a literal structure of steel and concrete that spans the empty space. You have to build a bridge.
And once that bridge is built, the magic happens. People can safely walk across the dangerous river. They can meet in the middle. They can exchange ideas, share food, and understand each other's perspectives.
When the author says sports are bridging gaps, they mean that the shared experience of a soccer match or a basketball game serves as that physical structure.
Exactly.
The sport is the safe, controlled environment that allows people who would otherwise remain isolated on their own cliffs to finally cross over and connect.
It's a profound opening thesis. However, if you are familiar with how TOEFL reading passages are constructed, you know that a writer cannot simply make a beautiful, poetic claim about bridging gaps and then expect the reader to just accept it without proof.
No, academic writing demands evidence. A standard essay structure will always present a broad theoretical idea and then immediately pull the reader down to ground level to look at a concrete, real-world example.
Which is precisely the move the author makes next. We transition from the abstract theory of societal cohesion down to the muddy grass of a local park. Let's look at the next sentence.
The text continues. For example, community soccer leagues often bring together people from different ethnicities, creating an environment where cultural differences are celebrated and mutual respect is cultivated.
That transition phrase, for example, is a massive signpost for the reader.
Huge.
It signals that the sweeping philosophical talk is over for a moment, and we're now looking at verifiable evidence. The community soccer league is the specific laboratory where the author will prove their theory.
There are two words in the sentence that separate a B2 learner from a C1 advanced speaker, honestly. The first is ethnicities. The text notes that these leagues unite people from different ethnicities.
This term is frequently misunderstood, even by native speakers, because it's often incorrectly swapped with words like nationalities or races.
Yeah, people use them interchangeably all the time.
But in an academic context, such as a sociology or anthropology paper, precision is everything. We really must untangle these three concepts.
Okay, let's start with the most administrative term, nationality.
Nationality is fundamentally a legal and geographic designation. It's determined by the borders of a nation state and the legal documents you possess. If you are born in France and you hold a French passport, your nationality is French. It's simply a matter of legal citizenship.
Okay, so nationality is about the passport in your pocket. How does that differ from race?
Well, race is a much broader, highly complex historical concept. It has traditionally been used to categorize human beings based on perceived physical characteristics, things like skin color, bone structure, or hair texture, which are linked to geographic ancestry.
Got it. So where does ethnicity fit into this matrix?
Ethnicity goes much deeper into the realm of human experience. An ethnicity refers to a group of people who identify with one another on the basis of a shared cultural heritage.
That makes sense.
It encompasses shared traditions, a shared history, often a shared native language, shared culinary practices, and sometimes shared religious beliefs.
Let's ground this in a real-world scenario to make it crystal clear. Imagine you're standing on the sidelines of a community soccer field in Paris.
Okay.
There are 10 players on the field. All 10 of those players were born in Paris and hold French passports.
Therefore, their nationality is identical. They're all French.
However, when you look closer at their lives off the field, the picture changes. One player might go home and speak Arabic with his grandparents, celebrating Moroccan traditions and eating Moroccan food.
Right.
Another player might go home and speak Vietnamese, deeply connected to the history of Southeast Asia. A third player might have a Polish cultural background.
So they share the same legal nationality, but they represent entirely different ethnicities. Their cultural heritages are completely distinct.
Exactly.
And what this text is arguing is that the community soccer league serves as the physical space, the bridge over the river, where these different ethnicities are brought into direct collaborative contact.
And what is the result of bringing these diverse cultural heritages together on the field? The text says it creates an environment where mutual respect is cultivated.
Oh,
cultivated. That is an absolutely gorgeous, highly academic verb.
It really is. And to truly appreciate the power of the word cultivated, we have to return to its literal origins. Just as we looked at math for the word integer, we must look at farming and agriculture to understand cultivate.
The historical literal definition of cultivating is the process of preparing and working on land in order to raise crops.
Imagine a farmer who purchases a wild, neglected piece of land. It's covered in hard, packed dirt, massive rocks, and aggressive weeds.
Sounds awful.
Yeah. If that farmer simply walks out into the field with a bag of wheat seeds and just throws them onto the hard dirt, what will happen?
Nothing good. The seeds will either blow away in the wind, be eaten by birds, or simply fail to take root because the soil is too hard to penetrate. The farmer's effort would be completely wasted.
Precisely. To grow something valuable, the farmer must actively cultivate the land. They have to bring in a heavy plow to break up the dense, packed earth.
They must bend down and pull out the weeds by hand.
Right. They have to physically remove the heavy rocks. They have to add nutrient-rich fertilizer and ensure there's a consistent water supply. Cultivation requires a massive, sustained, and highly intentional output of energy to create the perfect biological conditions for a seed to survive and thrive.
Taking that intense agricultural process and applying it figuratively to human psychology is what makes this sentence so powerful.
It really does.
When the author writes that mutual respect is cultivated, they are explicitly stating that respect does not happen by accident.
No, it's not a passive occurrence. You cannot simply shove people of different ethnicities into a crowded subway car, close the doors, and expect deep mutual respect to magically appear.
Building on your farming analogy, the busy streets of a major city are like the hard, unplowed dirt. Everyone is rushing to work, keeping their heads down, ignoring each other.
Exactly.
If you throw the seeds of respect onto the concrete sidewalk of daily city life, they will not grow. There is no time, no space, and no structure for human connection to take root.
So in this metaphor, what role does the soccer league play?
The organized soccer league is the plowed, fertilized soil. The people who organize the league are doing the hard work of cultivation.
Oh, I see.
By establishing clear rules, scheduling practices every Tuesday evening, buying uniforms, and giving the players a shared, unified goal of winning a championship, they are breaking up the hard dirt of isolation.
Right. They are creating a structured, safe, and deliberate environment where the seeds of understanding and respect actually have the fertile ground they need to grow over the course of a long season. That is a phenomenal breakdown. It really highlights how much meaning a single academic verb can carry. And for our listeners, it's important to practice the collocations for this word too.
Like what?
Well, in professional environments, you might need to cultivate a relationship with a difficult new client. If you're learning to play the piano, you have to cultivate the skill of reading sheet music. It always implies steady, deliberate, and intentional effort over time.
The structural flow of the passage up to this point is a textbook example of academic writing. We saw the broad thesis statement about social cohesion, followed instantly by the localized proof of the soccer pitch.
Yeah, general to specific.
Recognizing this pattern is like having a map of the maze before you walk into it. It allows your brain to predict what information is coming next, which drastically improves your reading comprehension speed on a timed test like the TOEFL.
However, reading a text like this requires a critical eye. If we step back and analyze what the author has presented so far, it paints a very utopian, almost overly optimistic picture of human nature.
A little too perfect.
Right. The idea that putting people on a sports field automatically generates cultural harmony sounds a bit naive.
I agree completely. I actually have to push back against the author's premise here. Let's think about the fundamental nature of competitive sports. By definition, a competitive game is designed to divide people into two opposing factions, us versus them.
It is an inherently adversarial setup.
Exactly. If you have two passionate community soccer teams and they're both desperate to win the local championship trophy, only one team can walk away victorious. The other must suffer defeat.
That's the reality of sports.
We've all seen the reality of this. We've seen parents screaming at teenage referees. We've seen fans throwing punches in the stands. We've seen players intentionally trying to injure their opponents. How does this aggressive, exclusionary tribalism fit into the author's beautiful theory of social cohesion?
You've hit the nail on the head. And a skilled academic writer knows that their reader is thinking exactly what you just articulated.
Right. They can't just ignore it.
A weak essay ignores counterarguments. A strong essay anticipates them, embraces them, and uses them to add nuance to the thesis.
Which brings us to the next pivotal moment in the text. The author pivots to address the dark side of competition. Let me read the next two sentences from the passage where the tone shifts dramatically.
Listen carefully to the transition words and the negative vocabulary used here.
The text states, however, the impact of sports on social integration is not without challenges. Competitive environments can sometimes exacerbate social tensions, particularly when favoritism or exclusionary practices are present.
The word however acts as a glaring red stop sign for the reader. It signals an immediate reversal of direction.
We were traveling down the bright, sunny road of mutual respect, and now we are turning onto the rocky path of conflict.
But I want to focus on the phrasing the author uses right after that transition. They write, "The impact of sports is not without challenges." It's a very distinct, somewhat strange way to phrase a sentence.
It is. Why wouldn't the author simply write, "However, sports have problems"? Logically, it means the exact same thing.
It does mean the same thing, but the rhetorical impact is entirely different. The phrase "not without challenges" is a brilliant example of a literary device called litotes.
Litotes, okay.
The totes is a deliberate understatement created by using a double negative to express an affirmative idea.
Let's break that down. Not is a negative word, and without is also a negative concept. Two negatives.
Yes. In academic writing, tone is everything. If the author bluntly wrote, "However, sports cause massive problems," it sounds aggressive, overly emotional, and almost as if they're actively trying to destroy the thesis they just spent a paragraph building.
It sounds like an angry opinion.
Exactly. But by using the double negative litotes, not without challenges, the author softens the blow significantly. They're gently introducing a serious complication while maintaining a calm, measured, and highly objective academic voice.
It shows the reader that they are a thoughtful scholar weighing all the evidence rather than a debater trying to score points.
It's an excellent technique to incorporate into your own academic writing when you need to introduce a counterargument smoothly. Now let's examine the next sentence, which features what is arguably the most potent C1 verb in this entire passage. The text says that competition can exacerbate social tensions. Exacerbate.
The pronunciation of this word can often trip up learners. It's pronounced X-A-S-S, or bait. Exacerbate.
To lock this word into your memory, let's dissect its Latin roots. The word begins with the prefix X, E-X. This is a prefix you encounter constantly in English.
Oh, yeah, like exit, extract, expel, extend.
Exactly. It generally means out, thoroughly, or to a great extent.
And the core of the word, the acer portion, where does that come from?
That originates from the Latin word acerbus, which translates to harsh, bitter, or sharp. You can actually see this exact same root in everyday English words like acid, which is a sharp, burning chemical, or acrid, which describes a harsh, bitter smell, like burning plastic.
So if we combine the idea of thoroughly or greatly with the concept of harsh and bitter, what is the practical plain English definition of exacerbate?
In plain English, to exacerbate means to make an already bad situation significantly worse. It means taking a problem that exists and doing something that intensifies the pain, the severity, or the bitterness of that problem.
I have a visual analogy for this that makes the concept instantly memorable. Imagine you are out in the woods camping, and you have a small fire burning in a stone fire pit. The fire is contained. It's a little bit dangerous, but it's under control.
That small fire represents a pre-existing problem.
Precisely. Now imagine you walk over to that fire pit carrying a plastic bucket full of gasoline, and you throw the entire bucket onto the flames. What happens?
The fire instantly explodes. A massive fireball shoots 10 feet into the air, completely out of control, burning everything nearby.
Exactly. Now, it is crucial to note that you did not start the fire. The fire was already burning before you arrived.
Right. You didn't cause the initial spark.
But by throwing the gasoline onto it, you exacerbated the situation. You took a mildly dangerous scenario and transformed it into a catastrophic explosion.
Applying that brilliant analogy back to our text, the author is suggesting that in many towns and cities, social tensions already exist. The fire is already burning.
Like historical distrust between different economic classes or friction between different ethnic groups living in the same city.
Yes, and a highly competitive sports environment can act as the bucket of gasoline.
Wow, yeah.
If two groups in a community already hold deep suspicions about one another, and you place them on a soccer pitch to fight over a championship title, and the game becomes physically aggressive, the sport is no longer acting as the mortar holding the brick wall together.
It's acting as dynamite. It violently exacerbates the pre-existing tension.
The author doesn't just leave it as a vague concept, though. They pinpoint two specific catalysts that act as that gasoline. The text claims tensions are exacerbated, particularly when favoritism or exclusionary practices are present. Let's define these two triggers, starting with the more common one, favoritism.
Favoritism is a relatively straightforward concept. The root of the word is favor. It refers to the practice of unfairly treating one person or one specific group better than everyone else, usually because of personal bias rather than merit.
In the context of a sports league, this is incredibly easy to visualize. Imagine a local tournament where the referees clearly have a bias toward one specific team. Perhaps it's the team from the wealthier side of town.
I can see that happening.
The referee blows the whistle and calls harsh penalties on Team A for minor infractions, but completely ignores the exact same physical fouls when committed by Team B.
Or consider the league administrators. Perhaps they assign the pristine, newly grassed field with stadium lighting to one team for practice, while forcing the team from the less affluent neighborhood to practice on a dirt lot full of potholes with broken equipment.
That is structural favoritism. And you can easily see how that would ignite the gasoline.
The players on the disadvantaged team don't feel integrated. They feel cheated and disrespected. The pre-existing social tension is violently exacerbated.
Now, let's analyze the second trigger the author mentions, exclusionary practices. This is a fascinating academic term because it serves as the direct, literal opposite of the very first vocabulary word we studied today.
I love pointing out these linguistic contrasts. Let's look at the roots. We just discussed the prefix ex, meaning out, and exacerbate. And the root of exclusionary is the Latin word clauder, which means to shut or to close.
Therefore, to exclude someone means to physically or metaphorically shut them out.
Contrast that directly with integration. We defined integration as taking the scattered puzzle pieces and carefully fitting them together to build a complete picture.
Right.
Exclusionary practices mean taking a specific puzzle piece, deciding you don't like the look of it, and throwing it in the garbage so it can never be part of the whole.
In a sporting context, an exclusionary practice would be a rigid rule or a systemic habit that actively prevents certain demographics from even walking onto the field.
Historically, you might think of a prestigious golf club that explicitly refused to allow women or minorities to become members. They were literally shut out.
Or, in a more modern context, it could be financial exclusion. Imagine a youth soccer league that charges a registration fee of $2,000 per child, plus the cost of travel and expensive uniforms.
That policy is inherently exclusionary.
Exactly. It effectively shuts out every working-class family in the city, ensuring that the league remains completely segregated by wealth.
And if you implement exclusionary practices, you are guaranteeing that social cohesion is impossible. You can't bridge the gap between two cliffs if you place a locked gate at the entrance of the bridge and refuse to let half the population cross it.
So let's take a moment to review the logical architecture of the argument so far.
A good idea.
The author presented a hopeful thesis. Sports unite us. They provided a local example. Community soccer cultivates respect. Then they introduced a devastating counterargument. Intense competition, fueled by favoritism and exclusionary rules, can actually rip a community apart.
This represents a critical juncture in the reading passage. Does the author simply drop their pen and conclude, well, sports have the potential for both good and evil, so it's a tie? The end.
Never. That's the hallmark of a weak essay. A high-scoring academic text rarely ends by merely identifying a problem.
True.
The standard progression is to establish a thesis, complicate it with a severe problem, and then present a highly targeted, engineered solution to resolve that specific problem.
You diagnose the societal disease, and then you prescribe the specific medicine to cure it.
Exactly. The author is about to show us how society actively fights back against the destructive nature of exclusionary competition. Let's read the next section of the text.
The passage continues, "Despite these issues, many initiatives aim to use sports as a platform for social change. One such initiative is the Sport for Peace program, which focuses on conflict resolution through team-building activities and collaborative sports events.
Once again, the transition phrase is the key to unlocking the paragraph. Despite these issues, signals another major shift in the narrative.
The author acknowledges that the gasoline and the fire are very real threats, but asserts that we aren't surrendering to them.
And to describe the fight back, the author introduces a vital noun, initiatives. The text states that many initiatives aim to use sports.
Initiative is a cornerstone word in academic, governmental, and corporate English. It's derived from the Latin root initium, which translates to a beginning or an entrance.
You can see this same root in everyday words, like initial, referring to the first letter of your name.
Or the verb initiate, which means to start or launch a process.
Right. Therefore, used as a noun, an initiative represents a brand new plan, a fresh strategy, or a specific organizational program designed from scratch to solve a particular problem or achieve a targeted goal. It is the formal beginning of a solution.
If a local government realizes that their city parks are covered in garbage, they won't just complain about it. They will launch a Clean Parks Initiative, a newly funded program specifically designed to fix that exact problem.
In this passage, the author highlights a real-world example called the Sport for Peace program. And the text notes that the primary goal of this initiative is conflict resolution.
Let's dissect conflict resolution. A conflict is a serious disagreement, a violent clash, or even a war between two factions.
And the word resolution is the noun form of the verb resolve,
which means to definitively settle a dispute or find a lasting solution to a complex problem.
So, conflict resolution is the formal, often psychological and diplomatic process of intervening between two fighting parties, getting them to drop their weapons, whether those weapons are words or actual fists, and guiding them toward a peaceful, mutually beneficial agreement.
But this raises a fascinating critical thinking question. How does a program like Sport for Peace actually accomplish this?
That's the million-dollar question.
Right. If we just establish that putting two rival groups on a sports field can exacerbate tensions and act like gasoline on a fire, how can an initiative use sports to create peace? How do they disarm the bomb of competition?
That is the core puzzle of the text, isn't it? But the author answers it by carefully selecting two specific adjectives. The text explicitly states that these initiatives focus on team-building activities and collaborative sports events.
Collaborative. That is the linguistic key that unlocks the entire solution.
It's the absolute antithesis of competitive. The problem we identified earlier was rooted in zero-sum competition.
In a zero-sum game, the math is brutal. In order for me to experience the joy of winning, you must suffer the agony of losing. We are actively fighting against each other to steal the same prize.
But in a collaborative event, the entire psychological framework of the game is re-engineered. You are no longer working against your rival. You are working with them to overcome a shared external challenge.
To make this concrete, let's picture how this works in reality. A competitive event is a standard 90-minute soccer match. Team A tries desperately to score goals while physically preventing Team B from doing the same.
But a collaborative event orchestrated by a group like Sport for Peace looks completely different. They might take the five best players from Team A and the five best players from Team B, mix them together, and form a brand new squad.
Oh, I see where this is going.
Then they present this newly integrated team with a massive physical obstacle course.
Imagine a scenario where these 10 players who previously hated each other are suddenly forced to figure out how to physically lift each other over a 12-foot wooden wall. If even one person fails to get over the wall, the entire team fails the challenge.
The psychology of that moment is profound. The brain's focus shifts instantaneously. You're no longer looking at the player from the rival neighborhood as the enemy you need to defeat.
You're looking at them as a vital resource you need to survive the challenge.
Exactly. You are forced to communicate, to coordinate your physical movements, and to trust that the other person will catch you when you jump.
By intentionally altering the rules of the game to mandate collaboration, the initiative bypasses the exclusionary practices and the toxic favoritism.
It is a brilliant sociological intervention.
Yeah.
They harness the incredible physical energy, the adrenaline, and the deep engagement that sports naturally provide, but they surgically remove the toxic, divisive element of zero-sum competition.
By forcing collaboration, they're aggressively plowing the soil to ensure that mutual respect is cultivated.
This structural sequence by the author is masterful. They didn't just present a problem. They provided a mechanical, engineered solution. It proves that social integration through sports is not just a random lucky accident. It can be a deliberate, scientifically applied tool for conflict resolution.
Up to this point in our analysis, however, we have maintained a very narrow focus. We've been discussing the people who are physically sweating on the field, the players passing the soccer ball, the teenagers lifting each other over the wooden wall.
We've been completely focused on the direct active participants.
Right. But if we zoom out and look at the reality of sports and human society, the percentage of the global population that is actively playing a sport on any given Sunday is incredibly small compared to the sheer magnitude of people who are simply sitting on their couches or sitting in the bleachers, passively watching.
The audience.
Yes, the millions and sometimes billions of passive observers. A comprehensive essay about the sociological impact of sports cannot ignore the audience.
Which is why the author executes one final massive shift in scale to bring the essay to its conclusion. The lens zooms out from the local community park to the global arena. Let's read the final paragraph of the text.
Listen to how the vocabulary changes to reflect this massive expansion in scope. Quote, the role of sports in social integration extends beyond participation. Spectatorship and fandom also play significant roles in uniting people. Major international sports events like the Olympics or the World Cup serve as opportunities for nations to come together and share common goals. The visibility of athletes from diverse backgrounds during these events fosters a sense of global harmony. These events often highlight stories of athletes overcoming adversity, inspiring spectators, and fostering a collective sense of achievement.
It's a majestic, sweeping conclusion, and the entire paragraph hinges on the transition from the active player to the passive watcher. The central noun driving this concept is spectatorship.
This is one of my favorite words to teach because it contains a Latin root that is an absolute goldmine for English learners. If a B1 or B2 student masters the single root, they'll instantly be able to decode dozens of high-level academic words.
The root is spectare, which simply translates to look or to watch.
So a spectator is literally one who watches. And spectatorship is the collective act of being part of an audience, the act of looking.
Let's demonstrate how powerful this root is by building a rapid vocabulary web. Think of all the English words associated with the act of looking that utilize the spect root. If your eyesight is poor and you need tools to help you look at the world clearly, what do you put on your face?
You put on glasses, which in more formal English are called spectacles, because they aid your ability to look.
If a police detective arrives at a messy crime scene and needs to look very closely and analytically at the evidence, what is the verb for that action?
They inspect the scene. The prefix in meaning into and spect meaning look, they look deeply into the details.
What if you're an older person sitting by the fireplace looking backward in time to analyze the memories of your youth?
That is retrospect. Retro means backward and spect means look, looking backward into the past.
And what if a fireworks display is so massive, so visually overwhelming and bright that every single person in the city has to stop what they're doing and look at it?
We describe that event as spectacular. It demands to be looked at.
You can see how this one root unlocks words like introspective, circumspect, perspective, and many more. In the context of our passage, spectatorship refers to the massive, passive, global audience locking their eyes on a single event.
But the author makes a very bold, almost shocking claim here. The text asserts that the simple, passive act of watching an event like sitting in your living room watching the World Cup can actually unite human beings and foster global harmony.
It seems counterintuitive at first. I mean, how does watching someone else run very fast on a television screen create a bond between two people living on opposite sides of the planet?
The author provides the psychological mechanism for this in the very last sentence. It isn't just about watching the physical act of running. It's about the human narratives that are broadcast during these massive events. The text states, these events often highlight stories of athletes overcoming adversity.
Adversity. That is a weighty, emotionally dense C1 noun that we must explore.
Let's apply our root analysis to it. It begins with the prefix ad, which generally means to or against, and the root verte, which means to turn.
So on a literal level, adversity refers to forces that are turning against you.
Exactly. Adversity represents the severe hardships, the brutal difficulties, the misfortunes, and the massive obstacles that arise in human life.
It's the feeling that the universe itself has turned against you and is actively trying to stop your progress.
Being born into extreme, grinding poverty is adversity. Suffering a catastrophic physical injury is adversity. Being forced to flee your home because of a war is immense adversity.
I think we need another physical analogy to make this concept stick for the listeners.
Imagine you're trying to run down a long road, but there is a massive gale force wind blowing directly into your face, a brutal headwind.
Right, fighting against you.
The wind is so strong that it pushes you backward. It makes every single step agonizingly exhausting. You have to fight with every muscle in your body just to move 1 inch forward.
That relentless, invisible headwind is adversity.
Now, let's connect that headwind back to the Olympics and the concept of spectatorship. When you sit on your couch to watch the Olympic marathon, you are not just watching a biological machine run in a circle. You are watching a human being.
And the television broadcasts often play documentary packages before the race, showing the athlete's background.
Yes. You watch a short film about how this runner grew up in a refugee camp, or how they shattered their leg 3 years ago and were told they would never walk again. You learn about the massive headwind they have been fighting their entire life.
And then the race begins. You watch them push their body to the absolute limit of human endurance. And when they finally cross that finish line, when they collapse in tears and win that gold medal, you are witnessing them physically break through that wind.
And what does the author say happens to the spectator in that exact moment? The text claims that it inspires the audience and fosters a collective sense of achievement.
A collective sense of achievement. That is perhaps the most beautiful phrase in the entire passage. Collective means shared universally by everyone in the group.
It's a remarkable psychological phenomenon. Even though I'm sitting comfortably in my living room, eating a snack, and I haven't run a single step or broken a sweat when I watch that athlete overcome their monumental adversity, a mirror neuron fires in my brain.
You feel it yourself.
I feel a genuine piece of their victory in my own chest. My heart rate increases. I might even cry.
And you're not the only one. Because the struggle against adversity, the feeling of fighting a headwind, is a universally understood human experience.
It really is.
It does not matter what your nationality is, what your ethnicity is, or how much money you have in the bank. Every human being knows what it feels like to struggle.
So when a Moroccan athlete overcomes adversity on the global stage, a viewer in Tokyo, a viewer in Sao Paulo, and a viewer in Paris all experience the exact same emotional resonance at the exact same second.
The shared, visceral reaction to human triumph temporarily erases all the geographic and cultural rivers that separate us. For that one brief, shining moment, the entire world is feeling the same emotion.
That shared emotional frequency is the global harmony the author is describing. It's a spectacular way to conclude the essay. It takes the very grounded, localized concept of a community soccer league cultivating respect among a few neighbors and scales the exact same sociological mechanism up to a global level, affecting billions of people simultaneously.
And for our listeners preparing for the TOEFL, this is a crucial thematic lesson. The exam frequently features reading passages rooted in sociology, anthropology, and global history. They love testing your ability to comprehend texts that explore how human beings interact, form tribes, and bridge cultural divides.
Understanding that this specific passage was never truly about the physical rules of soccer or the Olympic Games, but rather about the underlying sociology of human connection, will dramatically improve your ability to answer the critical thinking questions on test day.
The sports were merely the vehicle. Understanding the human condition was the destination.
We've now successfully traversed the entire passage, analyzing the logic and the linguistics from the opening thesis all the way to the global conclusion.
Which means it's time to look back at the map of the territory we just conquered and consolidate our learning. Let's summarize the journey.
I'm going to walk you through a plain English summary of the narrative arc of this entire article. As I describe the flow, I want you to visualize the logical steps the author took to build their argument.
Think of this as the skeleton of the essay.
We began with the core thesis. The author posited that sports serve to integrate society, acting as the crucial glue, the cohesion necessary to bind diverse groups of people together. Then, the author provided grounded evidence, showing us local community soccer leagues acting as the fertile, cultivated soil where mutual respect can grow between different ethnicities.
But the author didn't ignore reality.
Right. They acknowledged the dark side, warning us that the zero-sum nature of intense competition, especially when infected by unfair favoritism, can act as gasoline on a fire, violently exacerbating existing social tensions.
The essential counterargument.
Following that, the author introduced the remedy, They highlighted specific initiatives like Sport for Peace, which intentionally re-engineer the rules of engagement to focus on collaboration rather than competition, effectively bypassing those toxic exclusionary practices.
And then the big finish.
Finally, the author zoomed out to the global stage, arguing that even passive spectators watching events like the World Cup are united by a collective, deeply emotional response to witnessing human beings overcome massive adversity.
That is a flawless summary of the argument's progression. If you can mentally map out a reading passage with that level of clarity on exam day, you will be immune to the tricky distractor answers they put in the multiple choice questions.
To ensure you're fully equipped to understand these types of texts, let's solidify the high-level vocabulary. I'm going to pass the microphone over to our resident linguistics expert for a rapid-fire review of the most critical C1 words we decoded today. Please give us the word, the precise pronunciation, and a clear, punchy definition to lock it in.
Let's anchor these into your working vocabulary. Word number one, integration. The process of taking separate, diverse puzzle pieces and bringing them together to form a single, whole, functioning unit.
Got it.
Word number two, cohesion. The physical state of sticking together tightly. The social glue or mortar that binds the individual bricks of a community.
Sticky mortar.
Word number three, exacerbate. To take an already bad situation, problem, or negative emotion and make it significantly worse, throwing a bucket of gasoline on an existing fire.
Gasoline on the fire.
Word number four, exclusionary. Practices, rules, or systemic habits designed to shut people out, lock the gate, and prevent them from participating.
The opposite of integration.
Word number five, initiatives. Brand new plans, organizational programs, or strategic beginnings designed specifically to solve a problem or achieve a goal.
Like a new program.
Word number six, spectatorship. The collective act of being part of an audience and looking at an event, built entirely on the Latin root for watching.
Spector, to look.
And finally, word number seven, adversity. The severe hardships, difficulties, or massive obstacles in life. The brutal, relentless headwind you must fight against to move forward.
Fantastic. If you're serious about upgrading your English, I highly recommend rewinding the audio and listening to that vocabulary list one more time. Write the words down. Practice the collocations we discussed, like cultivating respect or economic integration, and force yourself to use them in your next speaking or writing practice session.
And above all, remember the structural pattern we uncovered today. Thesis, local example, complication, engineered solution, global implication. Recognizing that blueprint will make navigating any academic text significantly less intimidating.
That brings our deep dive into the sociology of sports to a close. But before you pull your earbuds out and return to your day, I want to leave you with a final, slightly provocative thought to turn over in your mind.
A philosophical exercise for the commute home.
Exactly. The text we just analyzed painted a majestic, soaring picture of massive events like the Olympics fostering global harmony and a collective sense of achievement. It's a beautiful academic theory. But I want you to test that theory against your own life. Think about your absolute favorite local sports team. The team you grew up watching, the one whose jersey you own, the one whose games dictate your mood on a Sunday afternoon.
Think about the team you are deeply emotionally invested in.
When you are sitting in the stadium or at a sports bar watching your team play their bitter historical rival, do you actually feel a profound sense of integration and harmony with the diverse people around you? Or, if you're being brutally honest with yourself, do you feel a surge of tribalism? Does the game make you love humanity, or does it make you feel an intense, almost aggressive division against the fans wearing the other team's colors? Does your own messy, emotional, real-world experience as a spectator validate the clean, academic theory of the text, or does it challenge it? It's worth thinking about. This episode was created by Lindy Upgrade Studio. Until next time, keep upgrading your English.